You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Julia Paul. Julia, thanks so much for being with me.
Brainerd, thank you so much for having me.
Julia, what are you working on now? What's happening in your studio? You're in L.A. at this moment, is that correct?
I am in L.A., and at the moment, I am using my kitchen counter as my studio. It looks like an apothecary. In the fall, last fall, I did an exhibition at a Native Plant Foundation in Los Angeles called the Theater Payne Foundation, and what I showed were photographs of still lives of native plants that served as food for Southern California native butterflies. And in the process of sort of teasing out what kinds of plants they need, and specific butterflies need specific plants, and often they need more than one plant. There's a plant that serves as the host, and there's a plant that serves as the food once the butterfly has hatched. And in doing that, I came across relationships that didn't so naturally fit on a kitchen counter, such as an oak tree. And that got me thinking a lot about how to represent the necessity of that distance and the kinds of choices we make about aesthetics, and then how in turn those affect the lives of animals.
So let's talk a little bit about that, aesthetics and how they affect the lives of animals, because what you were just talking about was specifically for a show, and I'd also like to know a little bit more about what's on your kitchen table, but let's first talk about just that point, the lives of animals, and I guess when you talked about the aesthetics and how they affect the lives of animals, do you mean, what do you mean exactly? Are you talking about the way you're taking images or something else?
I guess I'm talking about a cross between the two, because on the one hand, you know, people talk about Los Angeles as not having seasons, but in a lot of ways what Los Angeles is missing is its native plants. And that's an aesthetic decision that people have made over time to plant certain kinds of plants in their yards, such as non-native grasses and certain kinds of flowers they find attractive and so on, that push out native habitat and then turn large areas into food deserts for other kinds of animals. So in some ways, our aesthetic decisions impact what we look at. Obviously they impact what we look at, but it also impacts what's available and how our ecosystem functions. So then the photographs themselves represent native species on a macro level, and there you're sort of getting closer up to what the plant might look like to an insect, but it was not shot in a way that I don't want to say it wasn't shot so traditionally. The plants were shot in mason jars and it was sort of looking at preserving in simple means. It's not that long ago that most gardens had tons and tons of weeds in it, and that people just, you know, didn't have time or the interest, or perhaps they grew food, but they let other things go in their yards. And under those conditions, insects had more to eat. And insects, of course, are the beginning of our food chain, and we're completely reliant on them for our existence and for the existence of lots and lots of animals, and they're experiencing rapid decline.
And to step back from that a little bit and look at the kind of work you've been doing for several years, it's all, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but all the work that you've done, the photography, the image making, it's been around these issues of flora and fauna and an extinction, and or perhaps not extinction, but about what you're discussing now, which is the reality of these species on the planet and our effect on them. Is that correct?
Yes, that's very nicely said and very observant. That I sort of, it's hard to photograph something that's invisible, that can be refuted, or for which you don't have, even though 97% of scientists agree about climate change, you know, to say something is definitively gone is very difficult. And in looking at the kinds of complex problems we have today, I didn't want to be apocalyptic. I was interested in, well, you know, what can we still do? What's feasible? How can we improve things for ourselves, but for all living creatures on the planet? And so when I had sort of stumbled on this, in 2010, I sort of stumbled on photographing critically endangered tortoises in a captive breeding program. And it led me to this thought of what was actually possible and how we could foster life and what that might look like. And then I wrote a grant and subsequently got it to photograph critically endangered frogs in captive breeding programs, and traveled to Costa Rica and Panama and Quito, Ecuador, as well as the San Diego Zoo, to photograph how does the last of something live, and what kinds of efforts are made to breed animals to continue their lifespan. And from that experience, I learned a lot about habitat and the problems of habitat that create problematic circumstances for in that case it was frogs, but frogs also suffer from a disease that is waterborne, and with no solution at the moment of how to treat in the wild. And frogs are interesting in particular because they're sort of the canary in the coal mine for extinction. They're the species that get hit the hardest first.
And it sounds like a lot of your work, especially the upcoming show, is done in service of, you know, this kind of education about what's happening in the environment. So one of my questions is, how is your work bought and go into collections? Is that partly how it's funded? Or are there educational institutions that are funding your work?
Oh, that's a good question. I think that I speak about it in a really educational way, but probably because I'm an academic, and maybe that is just a shortcoming to the opening that it might have. It's interesting because there's a sort of clear divide, our expectation that such work belongs in sites like natural history museums, et cetera. And, of course, that doesn't necessarily spread the ideas behind the work to a larger audience. So I'm still sort of figuring out what the audience is. I have always tried to be very simple about how I approach work in terms of making it, to keep it cost effective. This last show I had of the butterflies was at a plant foundation, but unexpectedly, a fair amount of the work sold out of the show. So it ended up funding itself in reverse. But with the frog work, I just wrote a grant, and I have done that sometimes. And I think that work was a little ahead of, I think we're in a more receptive place for that work now than when I had initially made it.
Mm.
So,
and
for example, a college, Cerritos College, just started a public art collection, and they collected a frog to put in their biology department.
And you said you, you're an academic. So as an academic, you're teaching right now. I'm curious how your work kind of dovetails with being an academic.
Oh, gosh, I do teach photography, but I've always kind of tried to keep my own practice separate from that. I seem to recall reading something about Ad Reinhardt teaching Japanese printmaking, or a version of Japanese drawing, and, of course, making completely different work. And I've always admired that and thought it was good to have some separation between one's artistic life and employment.
Right. And so tell me what's happening on your kitchen table right now. What is it that you're working on there exactly?
Well, it looks like a sizable mess at the moment. I collected all these acorns in the fall. There are five species of oak trees in the state of California. I think they managed to collect acorns from four of them. And so there's a lot of acorns and lids of acorns, and there is a branch from a sycamore tree, and several oak galls, and sycamore seeds, and some dried out California sunflowers, which is a universal food for butterflies.
And so what will you be making prints of? Like, what is this set up for?
Oh, so at the moment it's sort of in between. I just shot something, and now I had this idea that I would let the last thing I shot dry up on the counter, and then I'd add a fresh still life to it. I should say that I have a sizable native plant garden in my front yard, and so it's wildflower season, so I'm pulling wildflowers from my own yard to photograph. I just finished photographing this plant called Bees Bliss, which feeds a lot of different kinds of bees. And prior to that, I had tried this sunflower photograph. And so I was thinking, oh, I'll just leave the old ones on the counter, and they'll dry up, and I'll add a fresh one in front. But then the other day, I was doing something, you know, cooking-oriented in the kitchen, and I completely disrupted my Bees Bliss. So that idea is probably dying, but it's, you know, it's the middle of a process of figuring and reconfiguring. So at the moment, I'm trying to decide, will I leave all that up, or am I going to wipe it clean and start fresh? If that
and
makes
so
any sense.
It does, but to ask even more about that, so what images do you imagine might come out of this? And and also, what are you using to take these images, if you don't mind me asking?
I have a couple images that have come out of this post moment of thinking. I mean, this is really the messy stage, because nothing is solidified again. I have a photograph. I've taken two photographs that I really like since December. One is of a nest that fell out of a tree, and the nest itself looks like a owl. And where one would imagine the heart, if it was a human, is the hole that a hummingbird was in, and there are these sort of bird feathers that line that hole. And then the other photograph I took that I'm quite fond of is of a partially nibbled on acorn, where the shell of the acorn is, you can see that some critter ate it, but then the nut is in place, only it has holes where an insect has eaten it. So I'm still sort of sorting around where these things go in relationship to each other, and I've forgotten the second half of your question, which I was interested in.
If the second half is, what are you using to photograph these? Because, you know, I mean, they're at such close proximity, the depth of field seems critical on what you're doing. So I'm kind of curious.
I am still shooting with a Mark II, so I have not gone to the most sharpest focused digital camera one can imagine. It still has a slight softness to it. But I'm shooting with a 100mm macro lens, and I am shooting at f/32, so that it's got a pretty sizable depth of field. And I have this collection. I've started collecting these old American canning jars, which said various kinds of things through time, you know, in the last 100 years, some things that are out of fashion to write on a jar, such as thrift or economy. Some of them say perfect Mason or ball ideal or strong shoulder. Various kinds of texts are embedded into the jar, and some of them were made when it was still sort of made out of a mold rather than how glass is done today. So those are a factor in the pictures as well.
And before I ask you the last question, I want to ask you about one other body of work that may be a little older, because we've been talking about things that are largely figurative, you know, plants and animals. You did a series called I Am Me, You Are You, that are much closer to, they all look abstract to me, and though I've read your writing about them, I don't understand what I'm looking at. They look almost almost look like something organic, like a microscopic form or something, but I'm just, you know, making that up. They really look entirely abstract. So what are those?
Those actually are entirely abstract. They're one of a kind that are made in a dark room with a color processor. And they're meant to do exactly what you said. They're meant to sort of seem like this macro world, or conversely, like something that could be seen in a photograph of outer space. And they are...
So darkroom-based, I mean, that's interesting. So we're just talking about, obviously, digital imagery.
There's
if
no
this
camera.
Is darkroom-based, and there's no camera, color darkroom.
And there's no camera.
So it's chemicals on the paper, because, you know, I know about using chemicals in black and white paper. That's fairly straightforward how you could manipulate them. But color is another world in terms of manipulating that in the darkroom, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And I never like to say how I made them, because it took a long time to figure out how to make them. And I think part of the charm is in how... I think there's something about them that causes pause just by the very way they are... the way they exist. So I think the closest way to describe it is more as a relationship to a photogram.
But it's also...
So you can't... The color processes are, you put your paper into a machine when it is dry and it comes out the other end dry. There is no way to really work... in the lab I work in, there's no way to have a wet chemistry process in the dark room, and there is a part of this process that's really about refraction and light.
It's fascinating. They're very beautiful.
Thank you.
So let me ask you one more question. The last one. What are you reading at the moment? I'm always curious.
Oh, gosh, I am a big reader, and I'm very eclectic about it. Connected to the photographs I'm making, I've been reading The Hidden Life of Trees, and I'm also reading a book on the California oaks. But I also just finished book. I just finished listening to the Fannie Davis book, the book about Fannie Davis and the numbers. I think it's on the New York Times bestseller list. So something completely different.
Julie, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today. I really enjoyed this.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it as well. I appreciate you having me on the show.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.